So I wanted to talk about effort this evening, which is a big aspect of practice, and what is the appropriate amount of effort, the Buddhist teachings on what's called right effort, or the completion of effort. And I also believe and have been told that it's one of the topics that the Buddha spoke of the most, and that practice requires some effort. Right? Wouldn't it be cool if we could just kind of hit the button and just like arrive into like dharmic land of ease and presence and no work? Right? So we have to be able to put effort into our experience. And so there's typically caught, and I'll get to it later, but there's a strategy that the Buddha talks about, which he calls the four great efforts, which is the ability to prevent, to overcome, to develop, and to maintain. So there's things we want to prevent, there's things we want to overcome, there's things we want to develop, and there's things that we want to maintain. And so he kind of parses them out into these four categories. And of course, what we want to prevent unwholesome mind states that have yet to arise. We want to prevent the arising of an unwholesome mind state. We want to overcome an unwholesome mind state when it's present in the mind. We want to be able to develop or to encourage a wholesome mind state that's not present in the mind. And if there is a wholesome mind state in the mind, we want to maintain that. So I tried to include that in the instructions tonight, to recognize moments when mindfulness is present and to understand, how can I maintain this continuity of awareness? What are the strategies? What are the conditions? How does one cultivate or maintain these types of mind states? And so I love this teaching because I feel like it's a simple way to address complex experience. And I think, as we all know, meditation, the mind, body, heart system is very, very complex, and it's not so easy to find your way around. Right? And that seems to be much of the struggle. And how much effort does it take to find your way around? And the thing about effort that's so interesting is this is one arena, probably of many arenas in practice, where it's very subjective. So right effort for me might be totally different than it is for this guy, because we have different relationships to effort. So essentially, there's sort of I'll give you some examples of wrong effort, which make for great stories, actually. So much of my early practice, I would do two things. The first thing I would do is I would come to the meditation hall, and I would come in there, and I would try so hard. Like, I was going to take the present moment and nail it to the floor. Like, just like, I remember walking into the hall and being like, I'm not going to think one thought this whole session. And I would just get in there and I would be like, all right, man, like, just like way too much striving. No way was that going to happen. I would get blown out and I would just say, fuck this. And I would just sit there and let myself think for like 12 minutes. And then I would get sick of that. And I would go back to the nail the present moment to the floor. So we see those two paradoxes and those two polarizations, trying way, way too hard, or just kind of like, whatever, man, I'm not doing shit. And you probably are already diagnosing yourself as which person you are in general, right? Are you the type A, gonna do it right, get everything done, accomplish, striver? Or are you the like, I'll get to it tomorrow, man, you know, like, no big deal? So we oftentimes bring these traits or these personalities, aspects of our experience, to practice. So when we sit down and try to attempt paying attention to our breath, all of our strategies around effort just kind of get right involved in the process, don't they? Right. So what is and how do we establish the right kind of effort? So I guess it's probably important to back up a little bit and talk about, if we're trying to develop and maintain wholesome mind states, which is the strategy of the whole Buddhist paradigm, one could say, if we want to develop and maintain wholesome mind states and we want to prevent and overcome unwholesome mind states, then what is a wholesome mind state and what is an unwholesome mind state? And these words become problematic because of words like wholesome and unwholesome, and we automatically go black and white, don't we? unwholesome is bad, wholesome is good, I should have wholesome mind states, but I don't have a wholesome mind state, so I must be bad. So we'd be very careful that we don't get into that trap, which you probably find yourself in more often than you might like to admit. And so if we look at the arena or the foundation of where we kind of learn to monitor mind states or mental attitudes, is that would be in the third foundation of mindfulness. This idea that you can kind of become aware of a mind state or a mental attitude. And essentially the Buddha is asking us to be aware of greed, hatred, and delusion. Is greed, hatred, and delusion in my mind? Do I have greed in my mind? Do I have anger, hatred in my mind? Or do I not? The presence and absence of either there's a wholesome mind state or an unwholesome mind state has arisen in my mind. And again, we have to be very, very careful that we don't diagnose ourselves as being bad for having the mind state, but just being able to recognize the mind state when it's there or not. So we could say that unwholesome mind states lead to suffering for ourselves or others, and wholesome mind states lead to well-being of ourselves and others. So that's a simple way to look at it. But again, if we start to become aware of these qualities in mind and heart, there's a whole wide range of those types of experiences. So again, he categorized them as greed, hatred, or delusion, as sort of, and of course there's many subcategories to those. So if we look at why does the Buddha talk in this language, why does he think about things in this way, is actually what we're doing in effort is we're really trying to cultivate. A wholesome mind state is something that you have to cultivate. And if you're going to cultivate something, you're going to have to put effort into it. And so we oftentimes might find, I don't know about you, but if I'm real honest, sometimes I intentionally cultivate unwholesome mind states. Blaming, judging, criticizing, I can't believe they did-ing. He's a fucking bad person. I'm going to build the case. And sometimes I find the cultivation of unwholesome mind states to be quite pleasant. So, in a lot of that, of course, is conditioned, it's learned, it's, again, we don't want to get into the paradigm of like, oh, I'm bad and wrong for doing that. It's just that, no, we get tricked and we get conned and we get pulled into these strong habit patterns of experience because we have been at them for a long time, and it's easier to get hooked into a habit pattern that has more momentum than one that does not. And so if we look at one of the things that I've done in the last couple of years that makes it a lot easier for me to continue practicing is this idea of trying to humanize this Buddha figure. And so I some people are interested in that or not so interested in that, but for me it's been very important for me to really take on this practice in a way that feels like I'm up for the challenge in all areas of my life. I try to think of the time and the place that this individual came from. And of course, if you made the terrible mistake of seeing that PBS special about the Buddha, about how he was born and stepped out of his mother's stomach and took 7 steps and said, I am the ruler of the universe, and grew up in this big palace, and the mythological story of the Buddha, which makes for a great story in an allegory sense of like, okay, this is kind of, they're making a metaphor, but actually, probably very unlikely the case that happened. So he really was a person no different than anybody sitting in this room. So he must have been conditioned in some way or another. And so I would think, and I read this book a few years ago called What the Buddha Thought, which is an interesting title. So that's why I read it, What Did the Buddha Think? And it talked about how was this individual conditioned by the world? What was his conditioning and why did he think about things the way that he did? And why did he develop this idea of a whole practice and a whole way of life that was rooted in the basic idea of cultivation or bhavana, the cultivation of wisdom and the cultivation of compassion. Right? So if we look at historical information, We know that he grew up in an agricultural community, and he grew up in a thriving time of great, great agriculture, and that his family was a tribe called the Sakyans, which they were sun worshippers, so they would have worshipped the sun. Right? So they would have worshipped the sun, and they would have grown fruits and vegetables and agriculture. So he obviously would have been very aware of the idea of seed and fruit, which is one of the ways that I hold the Buddhist teachings, is that there's seeds and that there's fruit. And how does the seed, what do you have to do for the seed to become a fruit? You have to cultivate. You have to give it care, and you have to give it attention, constant care, constant attention, and you have to kind of coax it into its most beautiful form. And so how do we not die in the vine, right? How do we practice and bring a constant effort to our lives and our practice in a way that we're cultivating the wholesome qualities of these seeds that we all have, the seeds of awareness, the seeds of kindness, the seeds of compassion. So he uses these analogies, I think, very much on purpose, because he would have been aware that this happened in the physical world. He would have been very aware that there was seeds and that there was a fruit, and that what provided that was sunlight and water and conditions. And so that creates nutrients, that creates sustenance, that creates health, and those are the things that create human flourishing. And so that there was not a poverty, there was a sense of abundance. So we could say, and I think it's fairly accurate to say, if he saw that process in the physical world as being true, then perhaps he recognized, well, I could probably just do that in here. Perhaps the mind is also applicable to the same logic and reason. If there's external seeds that can be cultivated into these delicious fruits of flourishing, maybe psychologically and emotionally one could do the same thing. Does that make sense? So it makes a lot of sense to me that he constantly speaks in this kind of language, because that would have been his upbringing. That would have been the way that the world made sense to him. And again, when we talk about the solar Buddha, or the idea that the sun would have been his great guide or his great inspiration, is that, of course, the sun represents two very obvious things. The sun represents light, illumination, awareness, it's shining the light. And that's sort of what we do in practice, right? We bring light, we could say, or we bring awareness to aspects of our experience where there was no light. There was an unknowing, we could say. So this light, this illumination, allows us to see things in a way that's more accurate and more clear. And so the sun also provides warmth, which we could say is compassion. It's a sense of caring and a sense of understanding that there's a pain and difficulty and loss, and that in the human experience that there tends to be a lot of unnecessary suffering. So I think it's pretty clear to say what the Buddha realized in a very real way in his time and a place was that people seemed to suffer in ways that were very unnecessary. Do you suffer in ways that feel, or you get a sense that they're pretty unnecessary? You're probably diagnosing yourself right now, right? It's like one of my favorite things to do. I'm like, fuck. I'm a mess. So if we're like on par with all of what I'm saying here, then it would make sense that what we want to try to do is we want to make sense of our lives in a way that brings light and awareness and attention to the areas of our life, the things that we want to cultivate. What is it that we want to cultivate? And what is it that we want to abandon or let go of, or I don't think there's a great word for that because it automatically turns into aversion. But I think pretty quickly, one thing I like about Buddhist practice, or the basic Buddhist perspective, is that most people, when they kind of realize the paradigm, that it's not that difficult to understand. Yeah, I do suffer in ways that are unnecessary. Perhaps I have some agency over that. And if there's practices that I can develop and tools that I can learn right out of the gate to overcome that, then oftentimes that can be the prompting or the encouragement the motivation for practice. That's my motivation for practice. And that's been my motivation for practice for a long, long time now. You know, I don't practice so I can become good at breathing or be good at paying attention. I practice because I see very clearly that my mind suffers in unnecessary ways, and that I can learn how that process happens. I can become aware of the habit patterns. I can become aware of the tendencies, the views. I can become very familiar with how that happens. But again, which makes it so hard, is I have to be willing to look at some of the ugliness or some of the emotional charge that comes with that. Because when we start to look at some of the ways that we suffer and some of the things that we struggle with, we often don't really want a lot of it to be true. And so this is where we can fall back into denial or trying to like pretend it's not true, or we think this is too much and then we don't want to bring effort to that. You know, and so that the mind is, in some degree, we could say the mind is either cultivating qualities or it's kind of consuming. Consuming distraction, consuming pleasure, consuming, sometimes the Buddha calls suffering khandha upadana, or clinging to the aggregates, which he says is the nature of suffering, is that we cling to feelings and perceptions and to habits of mind. And he actually says that he talks about it in the sense of feeding. And in one place he talks about it as being eaten alive by your thoughts. You ever feel like you've been you're just being eaten by your mind? My mind is just eating me. Consuming, this kind of consuming experience of suffering. So he uses some pretty intense analogies and language to describe that experience, but I think when we really feel like we're caught in the grips of our suffering and our mental processes that sort of dictate that, we can probably start to be inspired to say, oh, there's actually a way to overcome that. There's a way to sort of not do that. So again, when we're constantly dealing with this idea of effort, one could say, and I think it's very true, that even in a 20-minute practice, or that right effort is actually necessary in every single moment of experience. So it can sometimes be overwhelming in that sense. So again, we want to have some kind of gauge or some sort of barometer so that we can begin to understand what the appropriate amount of effort for us is. I don't know about you, but when I know that a lot of my self-criticism or self-blame or some of the ways in which I give myself a hard time has been a result of looking back at things and saying, you know, I didn't really give that a very sincere attempt. You know? Or like, you know, when my practice wanes or I don't get on retreat or when I'm not doing the things that I kind of know I should be doing, I suffer. I do. I'm like, man, I'm not even trying anymore. I'm just like consuming distraction and like food and, you know, digital garbage off the screen. This feeding, eating, scrolling through endless fucking digital trash, looking for a hit of pleasant. Which I did like probably a lot today. You know. And I it doesn't make me feel good actually. It doesn't. So I try to find myself bringing awareness to experiences when I feel like I'm in consumption mode. I'm just consuming. It's just like trying to drop into my body, into my heart a little bit and be like, this doesn't actually feel so good. I'm not cultivating anything right now. Except for like garbage, you know. So we want to kind of be careful that we don't, A, let what I'm saying kind of bum us out and give ourselves a hard time. But at the same time, being pragmatic and realistic about ways in which you could start developing some better effort in areas like starting like literally like right now. And that's where I find that this idea that the Dharma is good in the beginning, in the middle, and the end. It's always good because there's always something right in front of us that we could bring our attention and we could bring our effort to those experiences. Right? So it's literally right here all the time. It's just a matter of making these series of adjustments. And so, of course, always the key with mindfulness or any practice is the key is in the recognition of experience. So if we're going to prevent unwholesome mind states that haven't arisen, we want to prevent them from arising. Sometimes, like I could get an unwholesome mind state to arise right now if I wanted to. Right? And so I want to be aware of some of the ways in my life, going through my day, going through my life, understanding conditions and circumstances where an unwholesome mind state might arise if I'm not careful, and I want to kind of guard my mind against that. And you probably are doing it right now. You probably know there's certain people, I'm sure you could give examples of, when I see these certain people in my daily life, automatically the unwholesome mind state arises. But the unwholesome, they're not the creator of the unwholesome mind state. This is where it gets to be. This is where the Buddha's always putting the ball in your court. Like, I would totally have a wholesome mind state if that person didn't work. That's not right effort. That's you're making me feel. But we want to be kind of aware of how this works for us. Because if we don't have the data, we just kind of get beat up day to day about, like, not really sure who, what, where, or why, or how. So being able to recognize what are your unwholesome mind state triggers in guarding yourself or preparing yourself for those experiences, so that way when they happen, you have some resources how to manage those or how to work with that experience. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. That's just one of four. And that will, if you just tried that tomorrow, busy all day long, guarantee it. Mm-hmm. Try that tomorrow. Try to be aware of situations where an unwholesome mind state might arise. And so if we fail at strategy number one, which we do often, we have the ability to develop strategy number two, which is being able to overcome an unwholesome mind state once it has arisen. It's like, oh, anger in my mind got in. I wasn't guarding my awareness, and it got in. And now the malware has been, you know, installed into my mind. And am I going to work with this unwholesome mind state that has arisen in my mind, or am I going to turn it into an external object that says, well, I do have hatred in my mind, but it's because of that object there. It's that the thing that made me do the thing. Right? You know that one? Right. So, and then you're like, well, wait a minute, does this apply to all phenomenon? Because I feel like, you know, do I have to be responsible for all of it? And kind of what the Buddha's saying is yes. Because if that unwholesome mind state causes suffering for you, it's actually in your best interest to overcome it anyway. Right? Because you're the one who pays the bill. So that's when we recognize it. I have anger in my mind, or jealousy in my mind, or envy, or any, or comparing, or contempt, or any of these ways in which we can recognize that there's something in my mind right now that needs to be overcome. And of course, there's various strategies on how to overcome that, which mostly includes turning our attention away from it, to not feed on it, to actually turn our attention away from the unwholesome state, or the grip of that unwholesome state, or the object or the circumstance of that, and trying to look over here. If I look over here, I don't see what's over there. Not that you guys are the unwholesome side of the room, but you get my analogy. We just kind of simply turn away. And this is why mindfulness skills are so important. Right? Because when we look at the mental training of the Eightfold Path, it's right effort, right mindfulness, concentration. So mindfulness is the thing that allows us to recognize whether these things are present or not. And so then on the other side of the coin, we have these wholesome mind states. So we want to be able to understand and practice the right of effort. How do we get a wholesome mind state that has yet to arise? How do we encourage or develop that mind state? What are some things that we can do to kind of let that thing come into our experience? Right? The example that comes to mind for me, because I like it, because I go out to eat a lot, because I love eating with my friends. And there's not much else to do in LA but to go out to eat, so I tend to do it all the time. But you ever have this experience where, like, you're having lunch with a friend and they come and drop off the check or the bill and you look at it and you get this inclination of like, I think I'm going to pay for lunch today. Right? You know, it's kind of like maybe low-grade sense of generosity. But then you go, well, you know, I probably shouldn't, or we kind of talk ourselves out of that, right? So a lot of times if I recognize that there's this like, so generosity, I would say, is a wholesome mind state. So if I want to develop that wholesome mind state, maybe I should keep my attention on that and be like, what does it feel like to be generous? Right? What does it feel like to kind of sit into that a little bit, right? And to not talk ourselves out of it, which a lot of times we do, because sometimes it might sound odd, but I think it's true that many times we have a strange aversion towards wholesome mind states, or they make us maybe feel a little bit uncomfortable at times. Or maybe we feel like we'll be taken advantage of, or a whole variety of ways in which we might actually not allow. So that wholesome mind state's trying to get in, and we're like, not right now. Not this time. So again, what are some things that we can develop? And so one could say that in the arena of right intention, of that actually all of the Brahma Viharas are this third kind of right effort, right? This development of a phrase, saying like, okay, may I be at ease or may I be kind. If you start to learn heart practice meditation, what you're doing is you're encouraging the wholesome mind state to arise. Just because you're encouraging to arise does not guarantee that it will. And sometimes the opposite arises, and you know, we do the best we can with that. But there's a way in which we want to look at, like metta bhavana, for example. The heart practices are a really great example of this third kind of effort, of putting effort into the arising of this wholesome mind state. One would argue, I would argue, that same is true for mindfulness. There is such a thing called right mindfulness, which we could assume there's a wrong mindfulness. But in various schools of Buddhism and the later aspects of Abhidharma of the Theravadan tradition, it's understood that mindfulness actually is a beautiful mind state, and that in actual mindfulness practice, that in and of itself is a wholesome mind state, which gives us really the opportunity to practice and to develop a whole range of beautiful mind states, in which they identified 26 beautiful mind states, and mindfulness is the first one that arises. And then so when we find that we're developed or we've encouraged or we're kind of abiding in a wholesome mind state, the fourth and final one is, how do we maintain that? What are the conditions? What kind of effort? What is it that I can do in this particular experience to maintain the wholesome mind state? Right? And to some degree, when we're practicing in a sitting practice or on retreat, when we're working with these practices in the long term, that's essentially what we're trying to do, is we're trying to maintain continuity of awareness. We're trying to have more and more and more moments of these opportunities and this maintaining of a wholesome mind state. And neuroscience would say in this capacity that short moments repeated become continuous. And I think the Buddha is saying the same thing, so I'll say that again. Short moments repeated become continuous, which is the nature or the theory of neuroplasticity. So that means if I can practice these short moments of kindness or generosity or awareness, if I continue with that, those moments become repeated and they actually become longer and longer and longer and longer and longer. So short moments repeated become continuous, and we develop this continuity of awareness, or the continuity of wholesome mind states, in which there can be, you know, many forms that a wholesome mind state would take on, things from mindfulness itself to kindness, to generosity, to renunciation, to compassion and forgiveness and appreciation and equanimity. And there's a whole range of these experiences. So one of the things that we want to be able to do is not become focused on the bad all the time, but if we want to develop a liberation-based lifestyle, which is the nature of the Eightfold Path, I want to develop a whole way of living that actually is prompting me into the experience of being liberated, then I want to be able to recognize moments of my life when I'm in, we could say, a wholesome mind state. Which I have noticed, I don't recognize that as much as I should, and that my tendency is often to take it for granted, because me being sort of an intensity junkie, if the wholesome mind state isn't at a certain pitch of pleasant, I don't catch it. I don't catch it. I want it to feel super good, as you like to say in LA, right? Like, I want it to have a pitch. So a lot of times, one of the things that we start to learn and practice, I think over the long term, that I've learned to appreciate is having more of more appreciation for the experience of subtlety, in a more refined awareness towards these subtle, lower grade forms of these kind of states, so that way we can learn to recognize them when they're present, even if the pitch or the tone of them is not necessarily high enough or capturing our attention enough to recognize. You know, and so again, we can look at these practices and ideas in a wide range of ways, and it can become complex and sometimes confusing, and my attempt is to not make you confused, but one, to appreciate the reality of complexity, but also to remember that essentially what we're doing is we're engaged in a practice where we are trying to cultivate liberated mind states or wholesome mind states or mind states of awareness and compassion and all of these words which we all kind of know, and that we're trying to overcome and abandon and learn how to really, I think the word that makes the most sense to me is to overcome these habit patterns of unwholesome mind states, which means we have to actually become familiar. We have to become familiar with them, and we have to become intimately involved with how they actually work. So we're going to, if we want to overcome something like anger, we actually have to understand and learn how it works. So we have to like allow ourselves to be angry rather than creating. And the one thing that I'll say before I end, one thing that we have to be careful of that I've been guilty of and many Dharma practitioners are, is trying to use these ideas of effort, the practice of right effort, as a way to repress emotional states or as a way to kind of create this suppression or repression or strategy where we're not actually working with these mind states. We're actually doing everything we can to avoid them. And one of the ways that I notice that happens for me is if I feel like I'm in some sort of, usually I think of consuming as greed, but actually I think that for me it's more like an aversion. So when I'm in a state of the desperately looking for the screen that will be pleasant, it's not so much that I'm greedy looking for pleasant, but I actually find that for me there's probably something that is present that I'm avoiding, that I actually don't want to deal with, that I actually don't want to feel. So when we start to use practice in this way and to really become working and understanding our own benefits and liabilities around effort, we have to be clear and we have to be on guard and we have to be aware of any strategies that feel like a repression, rather than saying, well, it's just right effort. Totally repress that one, right? So I think that's all I want to say. We're almost out of time. I want to leave some space for questions. And as many of you know, that I will be parting ways to Colorado to cultivate fruit trees and gardens and agriculture, and trying to be less of a consumer, which is one of the reasons I brought this into the talk tonight, is I have been feeling like a little bit out of integrity or not feeling super positive around my relationship to consuming and buying and the amount of, you know, plastic cups that I purchase every week and the amount of trash that I throw away and the amount of resources that I consume doesn't actually feel so good to me. So I'm trying to make some changes to become more ecologically aware. And one thing that makes it easy to recognize is it is fucking hot. And I think that it's kind of our fault that it's so hot, apparently. This is not just some random event. Like, actually, it's getting hotter. And I'm not interested in turning up the heat on that one. So thank you for your attention. I appreciate it. And I'll take any questions that you might have this evening. So thank you.